Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about teaching because I've been in this university program for a number of years now, and I had a lot of reasons to go and get a PhD, some very personal ones, and also just kind of wanted to take a break and go back into school mode and have a structure to write a big, long, complicated book, which I'm in the midst of. But I have been thinking a lot about where teaching happens, where education happens, where I want to teach, how I would like to create environments where myself and others can discover new connections, new bodies of knowledge, and bring those into our lives. And it's a tricky problem these days because I can say it both from a reader of the news and as a participant that in a lot of ways the educational system is kind of broken. I would might even say rotten in a number of ways. And we could go into those, but that's another question. More to the point though is really what the alternative is. How we create structures that draw from the best aspects of our own maybe university experience or conventional schooling and bring them into different environments for different people, for different goals, but not losing some of the rigor, some of the intensity, and some of the sort of criticality I associate with a good scholarship in good universities. I mean, when I started to give public lectures, I started out at a New Age center in New York called the Open Center, and they gave me free rein, and I talked about all sorts of crazy stuff and had a lot of people would come back for different talks because they liked the way I was doing things. And it was kind of interesting because it was sort of scholarship and sort of not, sort of free thinking, sort of just a bunch of friends together. And in this weird zone, it was a zone of workshops, of spiritual techniques, spiritual traditions, gurus, that kind of teaching, which is sort of a whole other ball game. You know, the teacher with a capital T, that's a different game than the one I'm talking about here, which is more about bringing peers together, some of whom may have more skills or more knowledge or more insight than others, but really want to create a real container to make something happen. And my experience with teaching outside of the university, teaching online courses, doing workshops, once a week, short classes through extension programs and such, is that they're very fun and they can draw a lot of interesting people, but it's often hard time to get things to stick. People get distracted, they move on, and when you don't have that grade and that kind of institutional structure, it's really easy, unless you're very specific about why you're there, to have a kind of educational environment. So it's one that's ongoing, and podcasts are part of it, and emerging internet platforms are a part of it. But I have to also say, as a at least 50% analog person, that the importance of face to face, of gathering in a particular environment, a particular space and time, and the kind of rootedness in a local environment to me also seems incredibly important. I mean, obviously, we're all inundated with information every day, setting off lights, possibilities, possible connections, things to pursue. And it's so overwhelming. And I know I feel overwhelmed by it. I even feel dulled by it. I feel even sort of cognitively impaired sometimes by the excess of data coming through screens. And so it's impossible to imagine a kind of solution to the educational or sort of enculturating process that does not involve at least some of the time in locality and in face-to-face, in bodies in a room or bodies in a field or bodies in a yoga studio. So that's where we're at. We're exploring that edge. And as I said, my whole career has been sort of navigating this interzone between traditional institutional learning and you know, the weird world of pop culture and New Age workshops and, you know, talks at festivals and all sorts of things. I mean, it's really been great, actually, all the different places and communities that I've been able to speak to and with in this weird career, which I usually refer to as more as a careen. But there's some big issues that are much larger issues that are raised about where and when to pass on what little we know. And so I'm very excited today to talk to some people who've been thinking about these matters and working them out in practice for quite a long time. I have known Isis, Indria, and Eve Bradford for many years and have long admired their participation in, I guess you'd have to call it sort of a neo-tribal psychedelic consciousness culture, putting on festivals, putting on dance parties, putting on conferences and symposium, and really experimenting with how you can bring knowledge transmission, whether spiritual or ecological, permacultural, how to, you know, how to make art, how to put on festivals. All of these questions of know-how can be folded and embedded in the larger gathering of in the context of joy, pleasure, and celebration. And how to do that is a very interesting issue, partly alongside events that they have thrown and other ones that we've participated in. I've been lucky to be around a number of festivals that, you know, were predominantly devoted to electronic dance music or crazy celebration, dancing, partying, music, but have tried in a variety of different ways to inject some kind of thinking, knowledge production, knowledge transmission, discourse into these environments. And it's been a very rich experience, sometimes frustrating, but often very illuminating. And Isis and Eve are just about to let loose upon the world another gathering that they've produced called Symposium of the Sacred, which will be taking place in Nevada City, California, in a week and a half or so, November 6th through November 9th. It's a 4-day festival with body practices, mystical work, local activism, music. You can check it out on the website, symposiumofthesacred.com, and we'll be talking with them about it in just a moment. But before that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Hey, so I mean, we've talked about this before, but since I went on about it perhaps slightly too long already, you know, I know you've thought about this stuff a lot too, because you know you're a librarian, or you have been served as a librarian. You give a lot of public talks. A lot of your talks are not just your own particular view on things, but you're bringing forward information. You're bringing forward the results of your own learning. You also, you know, went through school and got your degrees and studied science. And so you've also kind of walked that line. And, you know, there's some wonderful things, but also some challenges in this question of how do you really, you know, kind of create a genuine educational experience in the midst of a kind of cultural situation that is not typically like a university. So you're at a New Age place, or you're at a festival. How do you work with that tension? I mean, you've done events in rock clubs. I mean, how do you balance that sort of need to or desire to bring forward information and really let people leave with something concrete with the kind of weird space that you often find yourself in?
It's a lot of weird spaces we find ourselves in. You and I, especially, Eric, I think, can wind up educating people in the darndest spots. And I think, first of all, what you said about the way the current educational system is, here's my view on it, okay? Currently, in regular school, it's not a participatory, really. I mean, you turn in assignments you're told to do, but it's more of like no one really wants to be there. They're not necessarily seeking knowledge you learn in some of these places. They're doing it kind of because they have to, right? Not even maybe because they like it, but they think the information is going to be good for them somehow because it'll be important or, you know, blah, blah, blah. Now, when you take our situation, what we're trying to do is we're trying to gather together people who really like this stuff. stuff and want to learn it because we really like it and want to learn it. So I feel like you can kind of provide those kind of higher education that aren't really higher education environments whenever you get together groups of people who, first of all, are just really sincere and open and want to explore that stuff without, like you said, all those like rules and regulations. It offers a sort of freedom of discourse where you're not going to be like marked with a red pen if you offer an answer which isn't in congruence maybe with someone else's answer. So I think the big secret is just open participation, and then teachers get to learn too. Like, I don't know about you, but when I kind of am able to really get that environment going where you hit that sweet spot where everyone's like excited energy-wise, all kinds of stuff can open and come forward, not just in like me trying to tell someone what information is, but vice versa. So I think the biggest thing is to just have everybody be interested in being there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's probably not going to be a problem for Isis and Eve, because it looks like a pretty fun gathering. So with that, let's invite our guests on. Thanks, guys, for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Monja.
Right. Yeah, good to hear you guys' voices. So, yeah, tell me, you know, I'm really curious, you know, maybe before we even talk about the festival I met and or the symposium, I mentioned this to Eve yesterday. That Nevada City is a very interesting place. It's a very interesting place in California. It's an important node, but a lot of people don't know that much about it, maybe in a good way. But I would love to hear a little bit about you guys, how you wound up in this area and what it was that attracted you. And I know that your symposium is partly a way to ground the community in that particular area. I mean, you're going to be inviting people from other places. I'm sure people will come from far and wide for this. But also, it's very much about a particular place with its own history, its own ecology, its own issues, its own particular culture. So I'd just love to hear a little bit about, I know you guys left more urban environments and you know, kind of made a choice to move more towards the country and to be in this sort of interesting place. So I just love to hear a little bit about what drew you to this place and what obviously keeps you really engaged there.
Yeah, that's a great question. Maybe I'll speak a little bit to that, and then Isis, do you want to follow up?
Yeah, sounds good.
I think, you know, the culture that Isis and I both met each other and you and, you know, our whole extended community in, the kind of West Coast underground festival-based culture, international festival-based culture, you know, once we had been doing that for a decade, I think a lot of us started to feel like we wanted to have something a little more stable in our lives. And, you know, we talked always so much in all of our work about how so much of the draw of festival culture has to do with this longing for something that approaches village life, and that desire to feel a part of a really connected, creative, dynamic community. But also, as we all matured, we also wanted to think about sustainability and wanted to think about consistency and, you know, what happens when you step outside of the temporary autonomous zone. And so, you know, this part of the world, for many reasons, drew a lot of us here, and there was this kind of collective momentum. There's a lineage of kind of counterculture people being here. You know, the Gary Snyder lives just over the hill from me, and, you know, people have a lot of the leaders of the kind of organic farming movement, Peaceful Valley Farm and Gardens Supply is here, which is, you know, a really foundational kind of voice in the organic farming movement in this country. There's a really strong community of young local agriculturalists here that's really inspiring. So a lot of people came here, I think, largely because the real estate is still affordable for California, and it's a town where there's a lot happening, and there's a feeling of a lot happening. So it's this kind of happy medium between being rural and being cultural at the same time, which is something I think a lot of us were really looking for. If we were going to settle somewhere, we wanted to be somewhere where it felt like we didn't have to completely sacrifice this kind of dynamic cultural life that all of us have been kind of prioritizing and leading for so long. So, And I think, you know, and maybe Isis, you can speak to this, a lot of what we keep coming to in our work as we look at the state of the world and as we look at kind of what's happening culturally, environmentally, socially, that a focus on local culture feels like kind of where hope lives for us right now, that it's a place where we have agency, it's a place where we have the ability to really feel like we have impact and relevance and really create change and create the world that we want to be living in a really proactive, really grounded way. So all of that kind of seemed very possible here, and people have continued to move here and kind of work together on creating that. And there's a lot of intergenerational support for that here, which I think is another really important aspect of that. But yeah, I'm curious to hear what you have to say as well, Isis.
Thank you, Eve. Thank you so beautifully and eloquently, you know, sharing about this community. Love the way you share. Well, my story, finding my way here, was connected to a really intense thing that happened to a friend of ours in Bali. A really close friend had passed. She died. And my salvation was to connect with a group of musicians called Fana Fiala, a Qawwali group from Pakistan. And I met them and spent time with them and sang and learned how to process my emotions of her passing with them. And so then they invited me up to Nevada City to come live with them. And when I came up here, I really found this profound, nurturing, comforting zone to really heal. And through that healing process, transform and continue to transform. And as I started to kind of get to know the community a little bit more and feel into how people found their way here that weren't born here or weren't raised here, there seemed to be this, like, agreeance that this land is very healing and that the land really is takes care of us. And this relationship with the land is really a lot of what has drawn people here, from what I've heard. And also the water. The Yuba River has been a very powerful healing place for me and our community. And there's something about the elements of the land and the water and being in the mountains. I feel like that attracts people. And this is also a gold mining community. And so there's a lot of gold that was and still is here in the land. And a lot of people feel that that's also an attracting point like that. And it makes it very magnetic and very activating as well. A friend of mine showed me this map that he had found where Edgar Cayce had spoke about this particular area that, you know, as major climate or, you know, changes happen on the earth, that there's something about this area that's going to sustain and be a stronghold. And I really noticed that. I thought that was really interesting and beautiful. And so I thought a lot about, you know, this flow of progressive people and that come here and leave and come, some that stay and continue to build their lives. And I feel that there's something about the gold, the water, and the earth that attracts a lot of progressive people here to not only heal, transform, and evolve, but really explore what it means to create a resilient community and resilient communities.
And, well, it sounds like one of the things you guys are doing in both by, you know, being in that area and also in terms of the work you're doing with the symposium is just, in a way, a very good way, taking advantage of the fact that there has been a kind of whatever countercultural and then progressive minded community there for a long time. I mean, there's not a lot of places in the U.S. where you can go to a basically rural environment that does have some kind of life in its towns that is so progressive. I mean, most places you go and it's like there's going to be battle lines drawn left and right. And California is unusual in that way. I mean, the West Coast in general, depending on what part you go, but there's, of course, a lot of you know, semi-rural or rural California, West Coast, it's extremely conservative, where the kinds of things you were doing might also work, but it would be a lot more confrontational. But there's a very special kind of generational inheritance in that area as well. And I was really struck by something Eve had mentioned about the intergenerational support for this kind of work. And that's actually one of my favorite things about sort of psychedelic and hippie culture to a degree, is that even though there are a lot of problems with, you know, we were talking about education before, how the older generation passes on information and practices and wisdom to younger people, there's also a lot of room for that, just because it's part of the imagination that it's totally understood. It's wonderful to have gray hairs at the gathering, as well as, you know, groovy teenagers, and that sense of a kind of village life where there's multiple generations is also partly about that whole generation that was able to come there. So I'm curious, like, how in the symposium, how has that been part of it too? How has that let you hook up with people who have been in the area, or people, elders, if you want to call them that, or people who have, you know, been doing this for a long time but see the value in connecting with, you know, people of your generation and then the younger people who are going to come, you know, who are younger than you?
Isis, do you want to speak to that? Or?
Yeah, sure. Well, something that Kalita Todd, one of the elder wisdom keepers that's going to be presenting, said last night, she said, "It's so valuable for me to spend time with youth because it keeps my mind and heart alive." And I really appreciated that she said that, because I feel similarly, that spending time with both our elders and our youth keep my mind and heart alive. And it really felt like there's this really shared experience of learning in all directions. And I really felt like just her authentic humility around that, teaching me about humility also. We're really blessed to have a lot of elders in this counterculture really present here. It's very rare. Like, one of our elders too, Marza Malar, she lives down the street. We talk to her every day. She's there for us. And at the same time, so many of our age groups are birthing, and so there's just children all over the place. Like, kids are very much a part of our daily life too. And that is really special and feels really important for all of us to be together all the time, learning together, you know. And the symposium particularly is really meant to create, is an environment for that kind of exchange to happen on a daily basis, to come together from all different walks of life, get to know the sacred and experience as the sacred intergenerationally together, and really feel that those rites of passages occurring by being in presence together. And that has been happening, even the journey to creating this event.
Yeah, it's interesting. Eric, you mentioned the Open Center, and there was a class that Isis and I actually taught there a couple of years ago that was about, it was called The Path of Offering and Developing a Practice for Spiritual Orphans. And this idea of kind of spiritual orphanhood is something that we've thought a lot about and worked with a lot, that I think a lot of us in kind of my generation, and I think, you know, for generations preceding us as well, have this feeling of kind of a lack of inheritance in terms of a lineage of an understanding of a sacred practice or a kind of wisdom system, you know, that we have had to kind of cobble our own together and do our own research and have our own experiences, and that's part of what makes us who we are, and it's something quite special and beautiful. But there's also, I think, a real desire and a real space to bring in the elders and bring in the youth and create that kind of intergenerational dialogue, because so many of us have been in this process of inquiry around these things for so long. So it seems like kind of a logical next step that we would begin to actually come together and begin to really create a lineage for ourselves. And that's been a real focus of the symposium in a lot of different ways, both bringing in elders and really honoring what they're holding and what they have to teach us, because there's a real lack of that in our culture in general, I think. We've kind of forgotten how to honor and value our elders, and also, as Isis said, how to honor and value the youth. So really reinvigorating that dialogue. There's a lot of really amazing activist, spiritual activist elders in this community. And that's really kind of the praxis that the symposium is, you know, intending to rest on and to really bring those things together. She mentioned Kalita Todd, who's, you know, was one of the founders of Peaceful Valley and is an amazing practitioner of alchemical healing, as well as a real local activist around agricultural issues, around cultural issues, and also Cafe Fish, who's a local permaculture teacher and activist. She's working really hard right now to legalize gray water in the county and having a good deal of success, actually, which is really exciting.
Can you just talk a little bit more about that, just to, you know, say what are the issues there and what gray water is, you know, just explain the kind of that issue?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you know, water is definitely up in California right now, and we're really bringing that into the symposium. There's going to be a water panel kind of council as part of the programming that's going to be on Friday. And Cafe Fish is one of the primary people that's on that council, along with Kathleen McIntyre. And so gray water is a way of recycling the water that we use that is still usable. So taking water that comes from doing laundry or water from the shower or water from the sink and reusing it somehow, whether it's going out into the garden, being used agriculturally, being filtered. There's a lot of different ways that you can work gray water into your, you know, home systems. And it's not legal in California, which many of us agree is kind of an absurdity in this time of, you know, high water concern. So she's an amazing educator around issues of drought and water and kind of a permaculture approach to those issues. So that's her story.
Well, just speaking of the connections with other with locals and with people who've been there for a long time, you also have I see at least one Native American woman, a Miwok woman, who's going to be participating, and I suspect there are other people. What is the relationship with the Native American communities like, and how have you engaged that? I know that that's been part of your guys' practice for a long time, and you've done this with other events and learned a lot of the tough politics that goes on in those relationships. But I'm sure you're growing in wisdom on that one. I'd love to hear how that worked in this situation.
Isis, do you want to?
I always forget who to ask.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we're still learning. We're definitely still learning. One thing that's been really beautiful about this community, there seems to be a lot of shared desire to learn from lots of different Native leaders of not only this land but other lands. And we're blessed that a lot of Native elders come here. You know, just in our house alone, the Arapaho, Cheyenne, Diné, Hopi, Miwok, Nisenan, Maidu, and what's local here is Nisenan, Maidu, and Miwok. And Rose Wood, who's going to be sharing, she's going to come and share her story as, you know, a Native woman, Miwok Native woman. She does a lot of work around here, and she works a lot with the Maidu and the Nisenan, which is really beautiful because there sometimes are miscommunications or challenges between different tribes on, you know, whose land that we're on and what's allowed. And she's kind of a bridge builder, which is really beautiful. And she was brought to us through our other elder, Marza Malar, who's Yavapai and Hopi. And so it seems to be this really beautiful, that between the two of them, we're actually learning a lot about a lot of the traditional rites and ways that Native people come together and build bridges. And one of the most important aspects that we've been learning from Marza particularly is the importance of storytelling and hearing each other's stories. Mm. And that's a piece that Rose Wood is really just, that's one of the things that she really feels like is very important also. And so they're going to come and share their stories and offer their different blessings so we can learn how to learn from them, you know. And it brings up so much emotion in me right now. I can feel my whole body just, like, shaking because I feel like through this journey, even I have been on learning how to work with different tribes and different Native peoples, it's been really challenging at times, honestly. And particularly because there is so much emotion around the indigenosity and imperialism, colonialism. And I can feel how my body responds to even talking about it, because so much of what we're learning about is how to approach, what to offer, and really how to listen, you know, continuously over and over and over again, and how to create an environment where we are able to really receive and able to really learn how to give. And
yeah,
it's very powerful.
It's important work, you know. It's tough. And I'm curious how, because you come from a community that has a lot of interest, sometimes superficial, sometimes more informed about Native American religious practices and ideas. And, you know, it's a place where there's a lot of easy appropriation, which of course is problematic and is often hurtful to living Native American communities. And at the same time, there's people who want to build bridges, and there's ways of learning. What have you learned about how to, well, just to how to make people better learners who are interested in these ways, but they're trying to find their own pathway through an environment that's filled with lots of really problematic, you know, residue from the past, misunderstandings, appropriations, misinformation. How have you found the way to sort of nurture that desire in an intelligent way?
Yeah, I'm so glad that we're talking about this. Actually, it's been a huge part of our journey from, you know, it really began in earnest working with Symbiosis at Pyramid Lake and the Paiute people a couple of years ago. We were asked to hold the sacred container for that entire festival, which was a huge undertaking and a major learning experience. And then again, we really took on that role as the producers of the village at Lightning in a Bottle with the local Chumash tribe at their new site last year. So it's something we've really been doing a lot of, and working with a lot of really amazing both Native and settler folks to really learn about what this idea of decolonization looks like, what this idea of, you know, building bridges and reaching across those different kind of membranes. And an idea that I came across a while ago that has been really helpful for me personally, and which I've shared with many people who we work with, is this idea, you know, privilege gets talked about a lot in these contexts. And there's a way in which just an awareness of privilege isn't quite enough, that, you know, there's a way sometimes when the conversation about privilege gets going where it's still somehow oriented towards the people that are holding the privilege, and it's about their experience as people feeling bad about being privileged. And it's really this kind of recalibration that needs to happen. And a way that I read an article a couple of years ago that talked about pushing back against privilege. And that's been a really, really helpful concept for me, that it's not just about being aware of it, but it's about pushing back against it. And one of the major ways that we can do that, as Isis kind of alluded to when she was just speaking, is about getting quiet and listening, and not just listening, but making space for these stories that do get marginalized and do get forgotten and kind of disappeared, written out. Really creating a place for those stories to get told and heard by a whole variety of people, so that you have, much like the kind of, I think, some of the strategies behind like Mandela's Truth and Reconciliation stuff, where the you get to be seen and heard, and both sides get to be seen and heard by each other and by themselves and witnessed. And the empowerment and the compassion and the understanding that comes from that is part of really what we're trying to do, is to really create a space where there's really a place for those stories to be told by the people whose stories they are, as opposed to, you know, by kind of imperial voices.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the things I just wanted to add to that too is sharing. I remember one Native elder, I said to him, you know, thank you so much for your teaching today. And he's like, thank you for honoring me that way, but all I'm really doing is sharing. That's all we're doing here is sharing. And I really appreciate that, so I just want to add that in there too.
No, thank you. This is really, really interesting stuff. A lot of questions, but we got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou, talking with Isis Andrea. Am I pronouncing that correctly, Isis?
Yep.
Okay, and Eve Bradford, a.k.a. Eve Lady Apples, about the upcoming Symposium of the Sacred in Nevada City, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Majidou here with Eric Davis. We are speaking today with Eve Bradford and Isis Andrea. And we're talking about the Symposium of the Sacred, which is coming upon us shortly, starting November 6th. And could you guys just talk a little bit maybe about what folks could expect when they attend? Like, I know you've been talking a lot about what some of your influences are and kind of like lifestyle type of things. But if someone was to go to the symposium, what kind of things can they expect to learn there?
Why don't you speak to that, Isis?
Okay. Let's see. So it's a four-day gathering that begins on the full moon on Thursday, starting with a procession from the cemetery to honor our ancestors towards the Luxart for an all-women's gallery art show. And a woman named Jen Ingram, who started the Visionary Art Movement, will be speaking about this 15-year journey of bringing visionary art galleries all over the world. I'm really excited about that. And then we process to another gallery, women's gallery show at the Haven Underground, followed by a water full moon ceremony with a lot of our local elders. I'm really excited about that also. And then Friday, so that's the full moon ceremony, and Friday we have a women's diviners, healers, and artisan bazaar with booths all the way from divination to Ayurvedic healing, to jewelry, crystals, and during that bazaar, we're going to have classes like the water panel that Eve was speaking about earlier. Rosewood and Marza are going to come share their stories as Yavapai, Hopi, and Miwok women elders. Then it will be followed by Jenna Basako, who's coming from Mali to do West African German dance. So that's Friday. And Saturday and Sunday, we have the two-day immersion that is a series of classes designed in the Tree of Life, Kabbalistic Tree of Life. So we're on a conscious journey from Malkuth, from Earth, all the way through Kether to the Crown. And each of those classes are related to a Sephira. And some of the classes that will be represented are things like the technology of prayer, the healing power of plant medicines, sacred economy, sacred warriorship, ceremony of song, ritual movement arts, a wide variety of a multi-sensual experience of getting to know body, mind, heart, and spirit through the tree. That evening, Saturday evening, we'll be having live music, performance art, ritual theater, and then Sunday evening we have a dance floor event called Heart Base to celebrate all the energy and all the work and all the what we learned throughout the weekend. So that's sort of an overview of the four-day weekend. There's so much happening in every way, shape, and form. And it's also multi-generational. And it's also an environment where a lot of community council and discussions around the topics of the sacred will be occurring.
That sounds great. One thing I wanted to ask both of you is to, you know, I know it's a huge question, but it's one worth, you know, engaging, which is, What is the sacred? And I, you know, I say that I've studied religion for the last few years formally and for my whole life before, and you know that's a whole kind of a whole can of worms. You know, what exactly do people mean by that? And when you talk about, you know, these practices and this whole gathering as sort of serving that, as being focused on around that idea and encouraging people to come to bringing their lives in accordance with that, or to find their own version of that. I'm really curious for you guys what that means, the sacred.
You want to go for it, Eve?
Sure.
It's interesting because this is a question that we've been asking a lot of people in connection to the event, and in particular with the Lineage exhibition, which is a photography project that Isis kind of dreamed up with a woman named Cynthia that's been exploring lineage and sacred lineage in a way, and creating portraits of women based on their lineages. And as part of that project, they've been asking women, you know, what the sacred means to them. So it's definitely a question that's been up in all of our minds. And I think for me, it really has to do with this notion of, you know, where we feel connected to something larger than ourselves. And for myself, my own practice and my own studies, that's very much related to the natural world and the infusion of the natural world with this sense of holiness, this sense of spirit. And I think that that's true for a lot of us who are involved in the event, that there's a real connection between the natural world and a sense of the sacred. And because there is this feeling of where do we feel connected to something that's larger than ourselves, to this web of kind of magic and synchronicity and divinity, really, you know. And for myself, that definitely is rooted in the natural world, and then the kind of multidimensional nature of the natural world. So not just the earth and the elements, but time and how time moves, and coming to have an understanding of time that is not confined by kind of conventional modern paradigms, but looking to more kind of older, more indigenous paradigms of how time works and how time moves and how we relate to time. And also this sense of offering, you know, that when we recognize the kind of hugeness of what we receive every day of our lives, of the abundance that is given to us by the profusion of the natural world all the time, every day of our lives, then the kind of natural kind of development of that is that there's this desire to give something back and to recognize that profound gift that we're receiving all the time. So it becomes what kind of my primary teacher, a man named Martine Prechtel, has called the ecology of spirit. So there's this real kind of living system approach to having a sacred relationship with life and with the world and with what it means to be alive. And so that everything that we do, the hope or the desire is that everything that we do becomes an offering back to the source that everything we have comes from. And so there's this real feeding. It's a lot about food and a lot about feeding for me personally. And this idea that, you know, we kind of are fed by spirit and we feed spirit, and that it kind of goes around like that, both in a very real tangible level from food and compost and giving back to the earth, and then, you know, on out from there into very kind of more esoteric, etheric realms of song and prayer and intention and gratitude and the way that we make every decision that we make being grounded in that kind of sacred relationship with, you know, the web of life.
Beautifully said. Thank you. Thank you for that. Yeah. Isis, you want to give it a shot?
Oh, it's just resonating, and everything you just share is so beautiful. Yeah, one of the things we did for this, as we were building this event, is we interviewed a lot of people asking them the question, what is the sacred? And for most of the interviews, the first thing that most people said was water and birth. I thought that was really interesting that was like a common meme. And one of the things, too, somebody had said that I really appreciated is it's such a beautiful opportunity to be alive, and the mere fact that we're alive is sacred, and to be able to interact with the life force of creation that shows itself in everything around us and everything within us is sacred in and of itself, and how to really tap into how alive everything really is, and how to honor and respect and strengthen our relationships with that life force so that we can make more beauty in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this, we've talked about that a lot on this show, about a certain sense of, you can call it animism, a certain sense that the things are have their own claim, their own perspective, their own things to say, even objects, technologies, rocks, as well as the more sort of charismatic figures of trees and plants and brooks and seas. And that once you acknowledge that or decide to believe that, depending on how you want to look at it, suddenly the world becomes relational. Mm. Suddenly you have to acknowledge and sort of apologize and be aware of taking, and there's this whole thing, and it can be overwhelming, and I think that's partly what scares people or puts people off from that way of approaching things, because then you are in a relationship and you do have rights and responsibilities. There are host guest issues, and I'm afraid that we're not as good at being either hosts or guests these days as I think people were in the past. So that relational quality seems really very, very key to me, and it's clearly something that's motivating your whole symposium. Another thing I wanted just to mention and ask about is that looking at both the not just the presenters but also the organizers, is that it's preponderantly women. And at the same time, you're not sort of framing it as this women's gathering with this and that, and there's obviously a lot of men involved, and probably a variety of interestingly gender-identified people. But I'm kind of curious whether that was sort of intentional, or really is it coming out of the fact that at this point in your creative lives, that when you need production people and when you need web design, and when you need people to fill up slots, that you just know a lot of really incredible women? Because it's an interesting shift when it's not about consciously, intentionally going out of your way to bring more women to the fold, especially into things that men often dominate in. But it's another thing when you're just like, well, no, those are the best people around. So I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I'd love to speak to that, actually, because really both of those things are true. It's both, that Isis and I have been working together for a long time, and we have found over the years that we really have built a team that consists of a lot of really amazing women, because that's who we have been drawn to work with and who it's been really graceful and harmonious to work with on a production level. And then also, I personally felt really strongly about not calling it a women's conference and not calling it a women's anything, that it is primarily female producers, it is, primarily it's all female educators, and that act was actually quite intentional on our part, that we, how many times have we gone to conferences where every presenter is a man, but it's not a men's conference, it's just a conference, and everyone's expected to just, think of this as normal, and this is the world. And so there was something that felt much more powerful about just having it be a conference, just having it be a symposium, that happens to be women educators and happens to be women producers, because they were the ones for the job, and they were the ones that really made sense to bring in and hold this and honor them in that way as the holders of this culture. And there are men involved, and where it's made sense for men to come in, they're certainly welcome. And we hope that a lot of men will come and participate, because it feels really important right now that these events where women leadership is present aren't just for women participants, and that we begin to shift that paradigm where everyone is comfortable kind of under the umbrella of female leadership, and that becomes more of a norm and more of a paradigm where there is just more of a presence of that in the world, because I feel really strongly that that's something that's needed and that everyone will benefit from and that everyone will really, receive a lot from.
Yeah, in a way that's almost a reason to pursue, alternative healing and yoga and a lot of these practices, because if you go into those realms, there's a lot of women who are doing the teaching or holding the talking stick, who have the power. And I've often thought what kind of effects that has, even just to think about yoga classes across the country. They tend to be predominantly women, but not overwhelmingly so. And most of the teachers are women. And how many guys, you know, sometimes you go in there and you see these guys look like, you know, big beefy jock types or whatever. And like, how many of them have like somehow shifted their space because they have to acknowledge that this is, it's sort of a different, it's a different zone. So I think it's a great move to like step beyond the strict identification and just kind of open it up and say, hey, this is going on. You know, let's just go forward without having to tag it exactly that way.
Yeah.
And what else are you really excited about for the weekend, Isis?
Oh, man. We have this really profound evening the other night. We had a symposium potluck, and a lot of people weren't able to come for various reasons, and all the women that showed up were all the women involved with the ceremonial aspect of the weekend. And all of the elders that were representing for the weekend came. And in that moment, I felt like this alignment and bridge building, the feeling of bridge building that hadn't quite felt yet. And so I would say what I'm most excited about is this bridge building opportunity and feeling that's occurring both, you know, physically but also spiritually. And I'm feeling really excited about all of these women and men coming together to really explore and share what the sacred means to them. That's what I'm most excited about, I would say.
And you guys are teaching a class together?
A couple of them.
Mm-hmm. What's that about?
Go ahead, Eve. We're teaching a class called The Rites of the Oracle, which has grown out of a practice that Isis and I have been developing together for many years. Kind of exploring and experimenting with oracular states based on kind of, you know, ancient traditions around oracles, both, you know, kind of Greek, Delphic cultures, Egyptian, indigenous practices. And you know, Isis and I had the opportunity to travel to Egypt together for the solstice of 2012 with the Dulab on a really amazing trip that Isis produced called the Great Convergence, and we were able to do an oracular rite between the paws of the Sphinx on the morning of the solstice, and that was the first time we had really done it in that way, and it was such a powerful experience, I think, well above and beyond what any of us had expected to occur, that it really inspired us to keep working with that and with building this skill set that was something that used to be a very normal part of culture. People would consult oracles. They would, you know, it was considered kind of, you know, a rudimentary aspect of culture that there were oracles and you could consult them. And so we've been experimenting with bringing that back into our lives and with beginning to understand what it is to access these kind of multidimensional realms of intelligence and wisdom and information. And so that's kind of the basis of the class that we're teaching.
Wonderful stuff. Did you bring in any oracles into the planning of the program?
Always, definitely.
Well, that's a cool example of like how you practice with it. What were some bigger decisions or bigger insights you got through your divinatory methods?
Well, it's interesting. I'll just speak very briefly. We did a transmission recently where I actually kind of went into oracular state for the winter solstice that has kind of served as a guide for our year in a way. And there were a lot of things that came through in that transmission, but one of the ones that made the kind of the biggest impression on us and that felt the most important had to do with the imagination and with the importance of kind of being a warrior for the imagination, that there was this kind of framing of the imagination as like the last battleground, and where, you know, where the kind of keys to the kind of shifts and the culture and the change live there. And I think that has been a real guiding force for us in terms of, you know, how to focus what we're doing is really, really not being afraid to push for liberation in the way that we're doing what we're doing and to really push boundaries and take a stand for what we believe in and not try to compromise it or make it soft just so that people aren't challenged. Like, we're excited to challenge people and really have this be a call to action and have this be a time to step up and you know, as you spoke in the very beginning of the show about really reclaiming education, reclaiming the way that our thoughts are formed and the way that we tell the stories we tell, and because we really recognize that that's what's shaping the world that we live in, is the way we tell those stories and the way we educate ourselves. And so we want to take part in that. We want to be a part of how that's happening, because the way it's happening outside of that is failing all of us miserably. And we really, you know, ISIS and I have always been really dedicated to not just standing on the sidelines and critiquing, but stepping up and making ourselves a part of that, and a lot of the oracular.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Okay. But that's a beautiful place to end. And thank you guys for doing your work. The Symposium of the Sacred, the week is starting November 6th in Nevada City, California. Thanks, guys, for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Maja.
Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Maja.
All right, and for me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.